Good afternoon. So last time we talked about instruction sets. We started by talking about what instruction sets are and aren't. They're the interface that we use to access the hardware, so the format of the machine code, the set of instructions and registers that exist. But they're different from the implementation, which we call the microarchitecture. And as we'll see later on in the semester, there are multiple ways to implement the same instruction set, which look very different internally and are different microarchitectures. We talked about one of the more important ways we might categorize instruction sets, and that's this RISC philosophy of having simpler hardware versus the CISC philosophy of sort of targeting applications, having complicated instructions that the hardware would hopefully implement to make those applications easier to write and or more efficient. And we learned that, well, there are maybe a few historical examples which are clearly RISC or clearly CISC. Usually we're somewhere of like some aspects of one, some aspects of the other. Then we looked at one particular ISA, that instruction set architecture, that we'll be using a lot in this semester, which is the YAD664 ISA. The one our textbook chooses, which is basically a simplified version of x86. So it removes a lot of instructions to make things simpler, and it has an encoding, which is actually something we can mostly fit on a slide, unlike the x86, which has thousands of extra instructions, all these special, different size registers and all those sorts of things, and has a very complicated encoding that we won't touch on in this class. And when we finished up, we were starting talking about what that encoding looks like. We mentioned we have this set of this table that you can find in your textbook of what that shows us the encoding. We have our various instruction types, each of which is a row in this table. And we have our first byte telling us which row we're in, based on these top 4 bits. And we also had some fill in the blank. So for example, we use the same row for our conditional move instructions, as well as a regular register to register move. And we have this fill in the blank to tell us which of those is it. And the same thing for jumps. We have a fill in the blank for all the arithmetic instructions. Which one is it? We use the same row for each rather than having extra rows and running out of numbers for our first 4 bits, and use an extra space for that. And we also have this for our registers, that we have numbers we assign to each registers, and we just have a 4-bit slot for every instruction that needs to specify some registers. And some instructions, when we finish up, also need to have a constant. So for our move instructions, we either have a constant we're moving into a register, or we have a constant we're using to help compute an address for register to memory or memory to register move. And for our jump and call instructions, we have a constant, which is where are we going based on this instruction, in the case of the conditional jump instruction, assuming the condition is true. And all these constants are going to be 8 bytes. We've just chosen that it's always 8 bytes every time, and they're always going to be a little endian. So we have 8 bytes where the least significant byte appears here. Okay. And I believe when we finished up last time, we were talking about this example. So here is an add1 function, and I have it encoded as, I have it as YAD6 assembly, so one possible version of it as YAD6 assembly. You notice that I couldn't do maybe my most straightforward x86 version because there's no add1 instruction, because we can't add a constant, so I needed to move one into a register and then add that. So now I have my YAD6 code. Let's convert that into machine code. And the way that's going to work is that I'm going to look up rows in the table based on what instruction it is. And I'm going to say, OK, the first instruction is an IR move Q. and I find out that it has a 3, 0, that's my first byte. It has an F and then a fill in the blank, and I look in my instruction, and that fill in the blank is RB, RAX in this case. So it's going to be whatever the number for RAX was in that table I showed you of all the registers. And then I have the constant, and our constant's going to be as a little endian, so here I've written out the little endian bytes. And then, so I encode that instruction, then I move on to the next one, look up that RAX is 0, move on to my next instruction, say, okay, it's an add instruction, that's one of the opq, so I copy the opq row, and I look at the fill in the blanks I have. I have a fill in the blank for whatever the code for add is as an op in the field of fn for function. And then I have RDI and RAX, and I'm going to need to look those up in the table to fill in those register numbers. So I look that up. So I find out 0 is add, 7 is RDI, 0 is RAX. And then I have a return. I look up return in the table. There's nothing to fill in, so it's just 90. And then I can transcribe this into the bytes that will appear in memory. So in memory, this is a hexadecimal. This program is going to have the byte 30, then F0, then 01, and so on. And that's what's going to be in the memory that appears in the executable eventually for this function. Yes?
I'm sorry, this is slightly off topic, but what happens when we write shift to something that's in little endian?
So the question is, since we're talking about endianness, what happens when we write shift something that's in little endian? Left and right shift are based on the representation as not bytes, but as an integer, so we don't care about the endianness. You just treat it as a number and figure out what shifting does.
Is that true even if it's not an integer?
So the question is, that true even if it's not an integer? We've only defined the shift operation for integers.
Okay.
So you have to treat it as an integer first to do a shift. Yes?
So F is part of the opcode IRQ, right?
So when we talk about opcodes, we're usually going to mean, I should have been clearer, we're usually going to refer to this or possibly to the full first byte. And the F is not part of the first byte or the first 4 bits. So the question is, why is there an F there? Like, why did they make this decision? And the observation you can make is that, well, they just decided that to make things simpler, that when you don't need a register in a slot, we're going to put 15 there, and this is going to arguably simplify our hardware. But they could have decided to not do that. Yeah. The question is, do we need a halt? So this is not a complete program. So the return needs to go somewhere, and I'm assuming that this is just the machine code for this function, which doesn't need a halt because you wouldn't like this program to stop when you call add1. That would not be a correct compilation. Other questions? Okay, so let's go through another example. So here I have a little loop in assembly, double till negative. And we're assuming, because we'll need the information later, that this label corresponds to this address. That after we do all our object file and linking stuff, we find out the double until negative is going to be at memory address hex 123. So let's convert this. So our first instruction to convert is going to be this add. So we have, again, we look at the row, it's 6, the blank for is it add, subtract, and so on. And for each of the registers, we look that up, we find out it's 60 is the first byte, then 00 is the second one. Then we look up jump greater than equal, and we find out that it's a 7. We look up what greater than equal is, we find out that that's a 5 in that fill in the blank in the second slot. And then we have to write out the actual address in the instruction. and it's going to be in little endian. So the first byte's going to be 2, 3, next byte's going to be 0, 1, and so on. And notice that I'm going through both assembling and linking here. I'm doing it all together. This is typically what we'll work on with Y86 because we're not going to run any really big programs that span multiple files here. And so to finally translate this to machine code, we're going to end up with, where is my? Having 6000. These are our bytes in memory are going to be 60, then 00, then 75, then 23, then 01, then 00, and so on. And that's what the machine code is going to be for this. There's a bunch of bytes. So any questions about this encoding procedure? Okay, so let's talk about the other direction. So I have some machine code here, and I like the assembly. What's the first thing I should do? So you're skipping ahead beyond the first thing. You did something that you didn't talk about doing.
Oh, I said 2 is the first column is the RRBQ.
Yes. So the first thing you want to do is figure out which column are we referring to. And the way I prefer to do this is I want to just figure out where are all the instructions before I start decoding them. You could also just go one by one. But the first thing we need to say is which column are we in? We know that these are set up, so we look at this first digit, which is this 2 here. And we figure out that we're in this case, the third column here. And what I would like to do next is just find out where all the instructions start. So I know that that column has 2 bytes in it. So I'm going to skip ahead 2 bytes and find out that then we have a 6 here. And I look that up and I find out, OK, that's another 2 bytes. Then we have a 6 here. Then I see a 7. I say 7, that's going to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 9 bytes, so I can count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 bytes. So the next instruction starts at this 2, that's 2 bytes, this 2, and then this 7. So that's what I would like to do first, but you could also just go instruction by instruction. But our very first step is look at the first byte, figure out what row it's in, and we know that we can look at the top 4 bits of that byte to identify the row. And therefore, like what the fields of that instruction are. So we find out where all of our instructions are. And then we go backwards to our old procedure of saying, what are the blanks? Well, we have for this 2, this, as you mentioned, this CC equals 0. Because that's our CC from the instruction. Our RA is whatever 1 is. And our RB is whatever 0 is. And we look those up in the tables I showed you earlier, where we have an entry for every condition code and less than and so on, and figure out what that means. And we find out that 0 is always, 1 is RCX, and 0 is REX. So we find out that's RR move Q. Always move register to register RCX into RAX. And we do a similar procedure for the next instruction, which is an opQ. So we have 0 as the function, we look that up, and we have 2 register numbers to look up. And then we have a subQ, it turns out. After that, we find in the same way. Then we have a 7. And if we look up 7, that's going to be some kind of jump. And it's a 7 with a CC of 2. So we're going to look that up. And then we have an address. And if we had like assembly in an assembly file, that would be a label. For the purpose of transcribing this, I'm going to start by just writing out that address. And it turns out that the address here is 84000 is the bytes. Since this is little endian, 84 is the least significant byte of the integer result. Everything else is zeros, so it's hex 84 is the overall number. And I'll just write out OX84. If you were translating this all the way to assembly, maybe after that you do sort of an anti-linking step of converting it back to a label once you figured out where is 84 in memory. Okay, then we keep going on and following the same procedure and end up with our actual assembly. So any questions on what I've done here? Anyone feel like this is something you could do? Like on the post quiz for this week? Okay. So that's our decoding procedure. So it's pretty mechanical. It's more complicated than IBCM, but not much more complicated. Okay, so now that we've talked a lot about this instruction set, let's go on to talking about implementing it, talking about building a microarchitecture. And for that, we're going to need to talk about circuits. And to talk about circuits, I'm going to need to talk about wires. So in this class, we're going to talk about wires holding bits. And in physical hardware, typically this is going to be represented by a voltage on the wire. Some voltage is 1, another voltage is 0. And we just say each wire, depending on what voltage it has, holds a bit. And it's going to be the case that on some end of the wire, we apply a voltage to set it to have a particular bit. And that's going to propagate to the rest of the wire with some usually very small delay. So in this sense, we say wires are going to send bits from one place to another in what we'll ultimately build as processors. Now, I could draw out circuits like this where I have a wire for each bit, but that's going to be rather annoying. We're often dealing with like 64-bit values, and if I drew out 64 bits of stuff this way, it would take up a lot of space. And if you think about like an add instruction, we have two 64-bit values that we add together, so that's three 64-bit values. And I really don't want to draw, 160 lines in a slide, so I'm not going to do that. And especially don't want to put 160 zeros and ones in a slide. So I'm going to have a more compact representation. So here, we can think of this group of wires, we can think of as a bundle of wires that represents, in this case, 26. Just a bunch of bits. And I don't want to always draw out each of the bits, so I'm going to take this shorthand where instead of drawing out each bit, I'll just say, yeah, there are 5 wires, they hold 26. That's a shorthand there. But even that's going to be too much when we're talking about a bunch of 64-bit values, so I'll take a further shorthand of only drawing one line. And that's just a shorthand for the bottom thing. It's just that, I'm not going to have enough space on my slides or time to actually draw each of the individual wires. But that's what I mean. Now you might complain, well, how do I know it's 5 bits? Well, you don't from the top. When we care, we might use something like this. We might put a slash across it and write a 5. If you see that, that means this is a bundle of 5-bit wires that are holding different bits. Usually, I'm not going to bother to do that just to make my slides less cluttered, but that's what we'll do if we want to be very clear about how many bits everything is. Okay, so any questions about these wire bundles? Okay, so another thing that we have to deal with is now we have ways of sending values. We also need to do computation. When we talked about bitwise operators, we talked about gates. And these are our basic units of computation. And the way gates work is we have some wires going into them. and based on their inputs, they produce an output with some short delay, just like when you put a value on a wire, it goes to the other end of the wire with some short delay. These work the same kind of way, that they're always just making their output be whatever function they compute based on their inputs with some tiny delay. And gates are these simple things we saw where you typically have two inputs and one output, and they compute, you know, just a simple function of bits. We're going to generalize this notion, especially since in this class we don't really care how you like do addition. We just care that, yes, it's possible to do with some set of gates put together in some way. So we're going to build logic and say that someone has done it for us, and I'm just going to represent that with like a box. So I'm going to say we have a box. It has a bunch of, it has a wire, you know, collection, a wire bundle as input that holds some value, and it produces a function of that value like a gate would, meaning that the output wires will contain some function of the input after some small delay when the input changes. So every time the input changes, so after some small delay, we'll have the function computed as the output. And we're not going to be concerned in this class with how you build this given a particular function. We're just going to say someone's going to give that to us. The function might be like add numbers together or figure out if the number is a multiple of 3, whatever it is. Someone's going to be able to build that for us, and this is what we're going to use to build our processor. Something to note is that when I draw this, the output need not be the same width as the input. That the function could, for example, if it's multiple of 3, it's taking a large value and producing a 1-bit output. If we're like squaring a number, we may produce a larger output. They're not necessarily the same sizes. Okay, so this is our thing to do computation. So let's talk about doing computation. So I want to do maybe the simplest possible sort of processor machine. It's just going to count. So I have a counter. I know to count, I need to be able to add one to something. So here's my first attempt at a counter, which is broken. And I'll tell you why it's broken in a second. So we have our add one, we take its output, we send it to its input. And let's say we start out with a 0 on this wire that connects the adder to itself. And you know what you would say? Well, we have a 3-bit 0 number. It's going to get incremented, so then it's going to become 1, then 2, then 3. I've written those out as bits. Like, that's what we would hope would happen, but there's a problem. And to think about what the problem is, let's think about what happens in between time 1 and 2, when we're going from 1 to 2. The values, as I said at the beginning, it's a bundle of wires. Each of those wires is represented with a voltage. So let's say we have charts of our voltages, and this is the 0 voltage, and this is the 1 value for each of the wires. So I just have a graph of what the voltage is. You know, there's a value that the voltage has for 1 and value it has for 0, and there's a transition. And because we're building this out of a physical circuit, you know, we can't instantaneously change from the voltage for a 0 to a voltage for a 1. There's going to be some transition where it has to happen. And our adder is not likely to be built, so it perfectly simultaneously changes both of the values at once. You know, they're slightly out of sync. So you see here, I've drawn it as, you know, this value changes a little earlier than that one. And that's going to be normal. Like, we can't build that circuit to like exactly do it in sync very easily. But the problem here is that, you know, it's not the case that we're at time 1 and then we have a brief transition and then it's time 2. What's actually happening is we're feeding this immediately into our adder. And the question is, what does the add 1 circuit do when it sees the inputs right here? Like, where we have 1 and 1, or when things are halfway in between, what does it do with that? And the answer is, well, it's kind of hard to say. And what's likely to happen is it's going to produce some crazy output during that time, and then it's going to try to interpret that crazy output later on when it propagates down the wire, and things are going to become unstable. And this picture is actually very optimistic. It implies that we hold the old value for a while, but that's not going to happen with this if the wire propagates values very fast. In fact, it's more likely to be the case that like we have another transition like immediately after here, you know, and it's changing rapidly and is really crazy. So that's why this doesn't work, is because things are unstable and we're sending that unstable information back to our adder, and we have this bad feedback loop where these little transitions where things are halfway in between and we're not sure if it's 0 or 1 or one thing changes faster than the other are going to keep affecting our output more and more and more. Yes?
Can I ask you a question? In order to combat that, would you have to add something like in the middle of add 1?
So the question is, how do we combat this? We will talk about that next.
And then my next question is that considered like cyclical?
So is this a cycle? Yes, this is a cyclical circuit. And that is why this is a problem. So we don't want to have a cycle like this. So how do we combat this? And the way we're going to combat it was with what we're going to know as state. And the problem we had is that this adder performs calculations all the time, even when we want to actually just remember the value we just computed and keep it around. So you need some place to store the value we're working on. So we're going to have some extra elements to store values, and these are registers or memory. So here's our corrected counter circuit. So I have here a register that's going to remember the current value we're adding one to. So rather than the adder immediately seeing when that changes, we're going to keep its input steady so it can add one without seeing something crazy happening. And only when we know it's stabilized on the next value are we going to use that again. And so this is going to give us what we want. And the idea is that, yes, there's going to be transitions, but we're only going to send things into the register when we're not in the middle of that transition. That there's going to be a signal not shown called a clock signal, which we're going to use to have the register act at particular times. We're only going to choose times when we know the input to the register is stable, and that's how the register is going to update what it outputs. So we're going to be adding one. So at time 0, our register is going to be outputting 0. And only when we've stabilized at 1 will the register copy in 1 and start outputting that, and it won't change until the clock tells it to. So while we're outputting 1 and the add 1 is computing 1, 0, the register will keep outputting 1 until the clock says, now we're done, copy in the new value. Yes?
When you say register, is that one of our RAX, RDX, RDI?
So the question is this one of our registers we name in assembly? So
because I feel like there'd be a lot of things that need this at any given time if we run out of registers.
So the question is this one of the registers we name in assembly? So this is most of the registers in our processor will indeed not be things that have names in assembly. But the things we have that have names in assembly will typically be implemented with this type of hardware.
But there are other registers other than the ones we named.
Yeah, so there will be, it turns out, especially when we talk about pipelining, there will be a lot of other registers that don't have names in assembly. So this is what a register does. And here I've shown a picture of its input and output and the clock signal. And in our processor, we're going to say that everything has the same clock signal, so it all works all this, you know, at the same time. And everything that happens related to the clock signal is going to happen at this rising edge of the clock signal. This is a choice our textbook authors made to keep things simple. And I've represented the input and output with colors, just representing a different value. You know, the input and output are going to be a bundle of wires, like we mentioned before. And the way the register works is it outputs a value until it gets the rising edge of the clock. At that point, it copies the old value and starts outputting it afterwards. So it remembers the value just before the rising edge and outputs it just after. So for our add circuit, you know, during time one, it's remembering the value 1, it's reading the value 10, and when that rising edge of the clock happens, it copies that value 10 to its output and keeps outputting that until the next one. And note that this means that the register doesn't care that the input might be changing in between those rising edges. That is fine. And that's why our clock, our counter circuit doesn't cause problems anymore, because we only pay attention to what's the value just before that rising edge. So even though, for example, in the case of our counter, at this point in time, like the register might not perfectly change everything all at once, it's okay because once it changes to the new value, we have enough time for the add one circuit to actually add that new value and produce a stable output. Questions on our register? Yes? So the question is, since it's always outputting something, how do we set our clock cycle so we actually like don't have a rising edge of the clock here? And the answer is going to be that we are going to, when we build our circuit, figure out how slow all of our add and one, all those other logic things are, and set our clock signal long enough that it's not a problem. But this is going to be something we're going to have to figure out when building our processor, how much time we have to have between these rising edges. And typically, when they do it in practice, they're also going to probably set it, they're going to really make sure it's long enough.
Why does the add instruction know how to wait? Like, how does it know to wait? Instead of, so if register output was in blue, why does the add instruction not just try to take that same output?
So the question is why the add, so note that what I showed you here, this is not the add instruction, this is something like a gate that adds one. So for our instructions, what it's going to turn out that we're going to do is we're going to make initially a design decision about our processor, which is that we're going to have these clock cycles, and during every cycle we're going to do the work of exactly one instruction. And that's how we're going to know what to do based on that rule. Okay, so registers are our most important piece of state, but we have some others. So let's talk about the state in general. So first of all, we have in our processor some of the things we've seen before are registers. And the two most notable are our program counter is going to be a register. That's how we're going to keep track of what instruction are we currently executing. And because I said that we're going to run one instruction every clock cycle, every rising edge, we're going to switch instructions. It's always going to reflect change every cycle to the next instruction we're running. We also have a register for our condition codes. Remember, we talked about ZF and SF. We're actually going to store those in one of these registers. But we have some other things that we need to keep track of, like what's the state of a program. So one is we need the program's instructions. Those need to be somewhere in our processor. And that's going to be what's known as the instruction memory. We also need the data that our program accesses through MRMoveQ, RMMoveQ. And you might say it's all one memory. We're going to have a separate box for that, known as the data memory, that's going to access the same storage. So they're both the instruction and data memory are going to access the same thing, but they're going to be separate boxes that have separate inputs and separate outputs. We also have a register file, and this is something which contains multiple of the registers that we have, like for the PC, but in a way that lets us decide which one to access for things like accessing RAX, RBX, RCX, and so on. This is where all those registers are going to be stored. Yes?
Can you explain what the difference is between the instruction memory and the data memory, like in terms of where they are located?
So the question is, what's the difference between the instruction memory and the data memory? So the big difference is what they're used for. The instruction memory is used to fetch machine code. The data memory is used for MRMoveQ, RMoveQ, pop, push, call, return. For the data part of that instruction. The other difference is that we only can read from the instruction memory, and we can read and write from the data memory. And the other difference is that we can read an instruction from the instruction memory, which can be up to 10 bytes, and we can only read and write 8 bytes from the data memory. So it's a different interface. Yeah?
So like for IBCF, like, were they like pretty much the same? Because like you could write to your
So the question is, like for IBCM, were they pretty much the same? So let's remember that we're talking about microarchitecture versus instruction set. So I could build a y86 processor where I had not a separate instruction and data memory, but had one memory, and I could only access a byte at a time. I could build that processor. Now it would be a lot harder because I'd have to like do multiple operations to do a single instruction, like read each byte one at a time, and then if the instruction writes to memory, write each byte one at a time, but I could do it. So the instruction set doesn't tell you what the data memory looks like except if you have a particular implementation in mind. So ours are based on the idea that we're going to do one instruction per cycle, so we have to be able to read 10 bytes in one cycle and write 8 bytes in one cycle, and so on. And given that, yes, for IBCM, you have probably 16-bit ones where you could write 2 bytes at a time and probably a separate instruction and data memory still. Does that make sense? Like, because you want to read an instruction and also, if you're doing the same microarchitecture overall, you want to read an instruction and potentially read or write memory from the instruction. The question is, can it be to the same location? Our policy for that is going to be don't do that. But that's not, we're not going to restrict that.
Like if you're adding like RAX to RAX and storing that in RAX.
Oh, for this is not the data memory. For the register file, we'll talk about that later. Yes?
So is it like the instructions hang out in data memory until we're ready to run that program, and then we load them into instruction memory to work with? So or is it like they're always separate machine code, all the machine code?
So the question is, like, do we have to move things from the data to the instruction memory or vice versa? So the answer is no. So as far as we're concerned now, that the instruction and data memory are basically just different interfaces to the same memory.
Okay.
Like they're just different ways of accessing the exact same memory. Later on when we talk about caches, we'll talk about what actually goes on, which makes us want to have these be separate boxes, and why these would be physically separate components in a real processor. So let's talk about our memories, and these access, like, take memory addresses and do things. So our instruction memory is simplest, and these are going to be what are known as combinatorial memories. So they take in a value, and there's no clock signal involved. Just like they were doing a computation, they compute the value at that address. So you can think of them as being like our logic blocks, but the function they're computing is what's in memory at that address. So they do it without regard to any clock cycles. It's just some delay after you put in the address, you get out the output of the value at that address. And since our instructions are 10 bytes, the output, the data output of the instruction memory is 10 bytes. And this is even in the case where we don't use all of them. If we don't use all of the 10 bytes, that's fine. We write a few extra bytes, and that's what's going to happen. So our data memory, which we're going to use for like the move instructions that move to and from memory to do the actual work, quote unquote, of the instruction, is going to be a bit more complicated because it supports both reading and writing. for reading, we have this read enable signal, which we have to set to true. And after that, it works the same as the instruction memory. We put in an address, and we get the output with the same timing, that there's no clock signal involved. It's just some delay after we put in an address. We get the value in memory at that address. This is how our textbook has chosen these to work. For writing, we set this write enable signal to true, and we put in both an address and an input to write. And the write happens at the rising edge of the clock. And this is going to be a common theme. Anytime we write anything, be it a register, or something in the register file, or something in memory, it always happens at the rising edge of the clock in our textbook's design. And the components we have work this way. So this means that we input the address and the value we want at that address. And as long as we have those ready by the rising edge of the clock, that gets copied into memory during that rising edge. Okay, so questions here? Yes?
Can you write enable and read enable at the same time?
Question is, can you write enable and read enable at the same time? This is something our simulator will let you do, but you shouldn't, because you probably won't like the results. Namely, that there's no reason to do it for any of the instructions, most importantly, that we have.
Why are they separate, then?
Why are they separate? Our textbook authors have them be separate because they want to be able to not read or write.
Okay.
Other questions? Okay. So then we have our register file. And you can kind of think of the register file as a memory, but instead of having a memory address, we just have a register identifier, which is one of the numbers we put in the instruction to say this is add REX or add RCX and so on. So the register file has more inputs, though, because if you think about our instructions, we sometimes want to read from two registers, very often, in fact, like add, we need to read two registers. So you need to not specify one thing to read from, but two. So we have a pair of what our textbook calls read ports, and they label these A and B. So there's a place where you can put in a register number labeled A, and you get have an output labeled A where you get the value of that register. And you can put a register number B, and you have an output labeled B where you get the value of that. And you can specify the same one or not. Works, and this is, works the same way reading from memory works. Once you put in the register number, just like when you put an address in the memory, sometime in the same clock cycle, after some delay, you will get out the value of that register right now. Okay, we just have two things we can read at once, so we can implement an instruction like add. We also can write, and writing works the same way as with the data memory, but we don't have a write enable signal. We just always have writing. So we have two pairs, because the pop instruction writes two registers at once, so our textbook supports two write ports on the register file for that reason. And they label these write ports E and M. So we have an E register number and an E data input, and an M register number and an M data input. And that works like writing memory. We input the register number and the data, and at the rising edge of the clock, the actual value register with that number gets updated. So we specify 0 for REX and 15 as the data. At the rising edge of the clock, REX will become 15, but not before that. So if we're reading from REX before that rising edge, we'll still read the old value up until that rising edge in the clock. So this seems fine, except for something like the add instruction. Now we can read the two operands for the add instruction, and we can write the output. But we have a problem, which is, let's think about an instruction like nop. For nop, we don't actually really want to write anything. So we could work around this by reading from REX and then writing back the same value to REX. that's kind of inconvenient. So our register file implements something to have us not need to do that. And that's the register number 15 is special. So when you write to register number 15, instead of writing to something, it does nothing. So this is our equivalent of write enable. And when you read from register number 15, you always get 0. And this is what our textbook authors chose to do instead of having a write enable signal for each of those write numbers. And this is why register number 15 in instructions is what the placeholder is for do not, no register to read or write. The idea is when implementing it with a register file like this, now we can just pass that register number uninterpreted, and in more cases, it's the right thing to do. Yes?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get why for the reading, the output's two different things when there's only one input.
So the question is why for the reading, the output's two different things? Where do you mean, here? So this time represents that there's some delay after we change the input, the register number, before the output actually gets set. It's going to be before the next clock cycle, because we'll make our clock cycles long enough. But there's going to be some delay. It's not instantaneous. And that's all that's trying to show. Yes?
So the registers we were talking about earlier, like the one that we put on our counter, are those in here or are those somewhere else?
So the question is, are the registers we talked about earlier, are these registers inside here? And the answer is typically yes. Typically the register file is going to be built from a bunch of those registers with circuitry around it to make the selecting by number work. This is not the only way of building a register file, but it is one of the more common ones.
So they're in there, but we just can't access them?
They're in there, you can access them. This is giving you a way of accessing multiple registers with a lot less wires, right? Because if we were accessing them directly, we need to have, for 15 registers, 15 inputs for each of the 15 registers and 15 outputs for all the 15 registers. And this is the idea that this is a way of accessing, choosing which one you access, that's what it's handling.
But the unlabeled registers, the ones that we don't have names for assembly, but that exist in the system.
Okay, so the question is, what about other registers? So there's going to be a bunch of places where, similar to our PC and our condition codes, we're going to say, oh, I need to store some information, but it's not one of my normal registers, but it's not something like I would use an add for. We're probably going to add a register outside the register file, just like the PC NZF for that. The register file registers, because they're precisely the thing we're accessing for an instruction like add or mrmove queue, are generally going to correspond to the registers you access in assembly. So these are where what you as an assembly programmer think of registers, these are what those registers are, usually. Okay, any other questions about this? Okay, so now we have our state components. Let's move on to actually doing computation. So one thing we need to do is actually compute things, and we're gonna have a piece of logic that is special that we're going to use a bunch, known as an ALU, and this is going to do the main computation for instructions. ALU stands for arithmetic / logic unit, and it's going to take in two operands, in this case they're labeled A and B, and it's going to take in a selector to tell us which of those operations that we could do are we doing. So most notably, are we doing an addition, subtraction, XOR, and and note that we use this for more than just the obvious operation. So it's obvious that an add instruction adds, but an mrmoveq instruction also adds to compute an address. And that's going to add is going to use the ALU in our processor. So this is our building block for actually doing most of the important computation. So these are our big components in our processor. So let's move on from there and look at building a simple processor. So I'm going to build a processor that executes add instructions. Nothing else. And to keep things super simple, I'm not even going to have that first byte, which tells me it's an add instruction, because that's the only instruction we support, why waste space? So our instructions are just two register numbers to add together. So let's build that processor from these components. So I have a PC I need, I have my instruction memory, and I have a register file because I need to add values in registers. We know those are where the registers were stored. So the first thing I need to do is I need to fetch my instruction. I need to know what registers am I adding together. So I need to take my PC, which holds the address of the instruction I'm currently running, and send that to the instruction memory. And we know the way things are designed, we'll get the whole instruction. And in this case, that's going to be the two register numbers. And the next thing I need to do, well, if I want to add these values, those register values together, I need to retrieve them from the register file. So I'm going to send these register numbers to the register file. And I need to take my instruction and split it into the two pieces, the two register numbers. This is a piece of logic, but it's really simple. We're just taking our bundle of eight wires and splitting it off into two bundles of four. There's not even any computation in here. It's just, you know, hardware, it's extremely simple hardware. And sending those to the register file as our two source register numbers, or read register numbers. So out of the register file, we're gonna have two bundles of wires with the values from those two registers. And what we want to do with those is add them together. So we're going to send them to our ALU. And then we want to store the results. So where are we do we store the results? Where does it go?
RYY.
RYY. This is an add RXX RYY. The destination is RYY. So we're going to send this to RYY. To do that, we have to send it to the register file. And we have our number of the register to write input, which I've labeled DestE. And we have the value, which I've labeled next.st. I say next because I mean after the rising edge of the clock. And I'm using R as an array of registers in this notation. So we see R of source A means the register with index source A. And R of DestE means the register with index of DestE. And by next, I mean the value after the next clock cycle starts. So I'll connect RYY to DestE and the value we computed to next RDestE. Okay, so questions so far? Okay, so if we think about how this works, let's say we have our program here, and let's say initially the PC register stores zero, so it outputs a zero. We get that through the instruction memory, and we read REX and RDX. In this case, the instruction at zero. So we send zero for source A, two, the number of RDX for source B. We get the two values together, 10 and 30. We add those together, and we find out that we have 40. So sitting on this wire, we have an input of 2 and 40, and then we have the rising edge of the clock happens, and we actually update RDX based on that. You know it's RDX to update because we have the two for DestE. You know 40 is the new value because by the time that rising edge happens, the ALU has computed 40. Okay. Yes?
What happens if, that two get sent to DSTE again?
So why does the two get sent to DSTE? Because we connected to it. Which we did because we wanted to store the result in RYY. And it's from the instruction. Is that sort of other questions? Okay. So at the beginning of the next cycle, we know RDX contains 40. How about the PC? What does the PC contain? Okay, so you're saying we don't know what the PC contains because there's no input for the PC. And your proposed solution is, gosh, you just told me we use the ALU to do addition even for things that aren't the most obvious addition in the instruction, so we should use the ALU. And that's a nice idea, but we have this problem that the ALU is already computing 10 plus 30, and it can't, the ALU I showed you can't do both at the same time. So our solution is that we're going to have, in all our processors, separate logic for doing the PC computation. So we're going to have a separate adder that just does, in this case, plus one for computing the next PC. And once we have that, we'll actually do the thing where we compute 10 plus 30, and then we read the instruction from address 1, because we incremented the PC, and after the rising edge of the clock, just like RDX was updated, the PC will be updated to 1. So we send 1 to the instruction memory. We get out not REX and RDX, but RBX and RDX, and we add 20 and 40 to produce 60 instead of 40. And 30 to produce. So 60 the next time to produce 60, and then we store that in the next rising edge of the clock in RDX. Yes?
One clock cycle from PC to the instruction memory and from instruction memory to split and so on and so forth?
So in this processor design, we have chosen that every instruction takes exactly one clock cycle. And we'll make the clock cycle as long as it needs to be to make that happen. We'll talk later on about other designs, because that's not the only thing we could do. So you could have had a design which like uses the ALU to compute the same thing, but we need more cycles to do that. Yeah?
So if we allow jump instructions, we wouldn't be able to use an adder for our PCs.
So yes, if we allow jump instructions, we need to do something different, which is our next topic as it happens. So we'll talk about what that is in a bit. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, does the plus one happen like at the rising edge as well?
So the question is, when does the plus one happen? So the plus one is going to be computed during the clock cycle. Like, because this is like a gate. Remember, as soon as the input changes, it's going to start computing plus one. As far as when the PC gets updated, that's going to be at the rising edge because our plus one chain produces this new input here, and then the rising edge happens, and we copy it to our output of the PC.
So, like, how many total clock cycles would that be? Because, like, after you update your PC, wouldn't you need, like, another clock cycle to write it into the register?
The question is, after you update your PC, so the PC is the register. So, for this, each of these rows, there's a rising edge of the clock. So after the first so on the first rising edge, we simultaneously update RDX and PC. And this is going to be our general pattern. We'll do everything that gets updated will always get updated for the instruction in this design all at once at that rising edge. And that's the design choice we've made. Other questions? Yeah?
Every line of assembly is one clock cycle.
So in this design, every line of assembly is one clock cycle. We'll find other designs might not work that way. Okay. Definitely won't work that way. OK, so you mentioned jump. So let's talk about doing a jump. So I'm going to do another simple CPU where instead of just only having the add instruction, we're only going to have jump instructions. Since we only have jump instructions, I'm not going to bother with the 7, that opcode part, tell us what instruction it is. Just always going to be a jump. So our instructions are just the address to jump to. So what does the CPU look like? So a cycle with a register to stop it from going constantly. Well, we already have that register,
okay,
which is
so
the PC. So yes, this is our jump CPU.
I'm uncomfortable with that.
Okay, the PC is the register to keep it from going constantly. So what's going to happen is that initially it's outputting 0. And as that's happening, we'll have 0 here. and we'll have the next thing here. And then there will be a rising edge of the clock, and then the PC will change from outputting 0 to outputting the next value of 0x10, and we'll read a new place from the instruction memory and read 0x8. And that will be the input to the PC. Okay, so the question is, how do we deal with that? And we will get to that. So this is how we do a jump. So basically, you know, at each rising edge of the clock, we copy the value we just read, start reading from that instruction instead, and move on. But an observation you made is that this is very different from what we did for the add. You know, how do we decide what to do? And we want to do different things based on what instruction we have, based on that first byte, which has the opcode. So we need a way of making decisions, and we don't have that yet. So there's going to be a hardware tool we're going to use that's going to let us make a decision. It's going to be our if statement for hardware, and that's going to be a multiplexer. So the way a multiplexer works is it has a bunch of inputs. In this case, I have 4, but it could be a different number of inputs. And we have a signal to select between those inputs. So in this case, that signal can be 0, 1, 2, or 3. And depending what value it is, we'll either select the input A, B, C, or D. And this is going to be kind of like a gate. It's just like a fancy gate. You know, you can write a truth table for it. You can figure out how to implement this with bitwise operators. We're not going to do that, but you could do that. And this is going to be our tool for making a decision, like, do I want to add 1, or do I want to take a location from the instruction? That's how we're going to make that decision, is with one of these multiplexers. So we're going to decide that input A might be add 1 to the instruction, input B might be use the address from a jump. So questions about how multiplexers work? So let's do our jump. So here I have my actual subset finally. So I'm going to include the opcodes because I have 2 different types of instructions. I have a jump, just an unconditional jump, which we're going to represent as a 7-0 followed by the address, or an up, which we're going to represent as a 1-0. And I'm going to implement both of them. For the NOP, what we have to do is we have to add 1 to the PC. That's it. For the jump, we have to go to the address, like we saw earlier. So let's build that, and I have the encoding here for my reference. So I'm going to first start the way we did before. I'm going to take my PC, which is going to be the address of whatever instruction we're running. I'm going to send that to the instruction memory. I'm going to get out my 9-byte instruction. I need to look at the first byte of it. And remember, we're using a mux, and the mux ends up taking, you know, once a 0, 1, 2, or 3, or something like that. So we're going to need to translate the opcode to something like that. So I'm just going to have a box of logic which implements the function to take 1 and translate it to 0, and 7 and translate it to a 1, just to select the right input to a mux. So now this mux is going to choose either the top input for a NOP instruction or the bottom input for a jump instruction. And it has 2 inputs that matter. So I wire up the top input to be the value I want for the PC for a NOP instruction, and the bottom input to be the value I want for a jump instruction. So questions about what I've done here? Okay. So this means that if there's an op, we're gonna, for the mux is gonna send through, we're gonna have a zero as the selector, and it's gonna send through the PC plus one value. If there's a jump, the selector is gonna be one, and we're gonna send through the dest value from the instruction. And that's what we're gonna end up with. Build this processor, and now we have a processor that correctly executes jumps and nops. We can extend this idea to do all of our other instructions all at once. So generally, when we're building our processors, we're not gonna just have cases where we want to do different things for what's the next value of the PC. We're gonna have cases where we want to do different things for, like, what do we input to the ALU, or what registers do I read or write? And for all of those cases, we're gonna say, what are our possibilities? And we're gonna have each one of them be an input into a mux, and we're gonna have logic which chooses the appropriate number to send to the mux to select the right input. And that's how we're gonna make our processor be able to implement any of the instructions. So any questions about that basic procedure? Yeah?
So a mux is basically like an on or off switch, and depending on what the input is, it changes like what is on or off.
So the question is, the mux is basically an on or off switch. So a two input mux like this, yes. Note that it generalizes though to more than two inputs. So in this case, it's like a four-way, four-option switch. Yeah?
Is there like a maximum amount that you could have like inputs?
This question, is there a maximum amount? You can build a mux, it's just built out of gates. You can build it as big as you like. You know, there's obviously a cost if you make it big enough, but you can build it as big as you like. So other questions? So that's our jump and nop. So let's talk about, say, nop and add. So let's say we want to make a CPU which does nops and adds. Where are we going to have muxes? So I'll give you a minute or two to think about this, decide it with your neighbor. Like, where do we need muxes to make a CPU that does nop and add instructions, the same format as Y86, so we have our NOP is going to be 1, 0, and our add is going to be 6, 0, RA, RB. Those are our instruction formats. So given that, tell me which of these do we need muxes on? Probably more than one of them. I'll give you a minute or so. Check with your neighbor and see if you agree. Clear. Okay, who needs more time? No one's volunteering. So who thinks we want it for A? Thinks we don't want it for A? Okay, who thinks we want it for B? Thinks we don't need it, want it for B? Okay, so there's a split on that. Thinks we want it for C? Thinks we don't need it for C? Who thinks we want it for D? And not? Okay, and how about E? Thinks we need it for E versus not? So, lots of disagreement. And part of the issue is that some of these are pretty subtle. So let's start with probably the most clear-cut one, which is going to be B. We have PC plus 1 for an op. And for an add, we have PC plus 2 because this is our instruction format is 2 bytes. So if it's Y86 instruction format, we need some sort of selector before then, before that. So that's the one of the clearest cases. So the next issue is that one of these needs to write to a register and one shouldn't write to a register. So the simplest way of doing that is to change the register number we write. This is the index of the register, that for a NOP we pass 15 and for an add we pass RB. And we can't just pass the same thing we get from the instruction memory because here might not be an F, not 15. So it seems like we need a MUX for that. Okay. But if you're especially tricky, you might say, well, what if instead we just read a register and write out the same value to the register? So that would be an alternative solution, in which case you could pass in whatever is here and not have the C MUX, but instead just have a MUX for D. But that seems like a less intuitive, harder to implement solution. So it's probably not what hardware would do, but indeed it is a valid option that would produce correct results. And if you are implementing the MUX in C, you don't need the MUX in D. Because if you're passing 15, you can avoid making the decision about what you put as input. You can always put the output of the ALU as input to the register file. And so what? It doesn't matter for NOP, but you can put anything there, it's fine. So you don't need it, but I'm not going to blame you for deciding I want to pass explicitly a 0 or whatever in that case, but you don't need it. Then we have the before the instruction memory's address input. Well, this is always going to be equal to the PC. Remember, our PC holds the address of the instruction. And the way our instruction memory works is that even though we have variable length instructions, we're always just going to read, enough for the largest instruction and just ignore the extra bytes we read, so we don't have to worry about passing slightly different things depending on the length of the instruction. So it turns out we're not going to need to make a choice here. We just always send the value from the PC to the instruction memory. And then we have A. So it seems like, well, add reads two registers, not reads none. So we should, it seems like, we should have another case where NOP passes 15 and add passes RA, RB. But we don't really need to do that because we can read from a register and ignore the value we read. So we can omit the MUX and just say, we're going to read from registers, but we're not going to look at the values. And that's not going to cause any problems. Okay. So I wouldn't blame you for saying, I should pass 15. You told me that's how I read from nothing. But you don't have to do that. You can still implement the processor 100% functionally and pretty easily without. Okay, so that's what I have for today. So next time, we'll talk about more complex instruction sets and maybe introduce our hardware description language.
Hello. realize that add instruction costs P